It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Our sleep doctor is back in the studio. Dr. Eric Dykin, a neurologist and director of the Sleep Disorder Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. From time to time, three or four times a year, we like to ask Dr. Dykin in to review the latest news and research on the field of sleep and disorders, and also to answer your questions. About 40 million Americans have chronic sleep problems. We like to hear from you. If you've had a new sleep problem crop up, tell us about it. Perhaps Dr. Dykin can give you some advice. No diagnoses over the air, but he has certainly helped plenty in the past. Tell us about your problem in sleeping, or perhaps you've changed something in your life and it's led to better sleep. Would you like to share that with us so that we can all learn, perhaps? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, tweet us at IPR Talk, or put your response on Facebook, Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. Dr. Dykin, so good that you could come into our studio again. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
A little later in the hour, I want to have you talk about a new discovery that birds can sleep in flight, that trees need slumber as well. Some interesting research there. But let's talk a little bit about the latest research having to do with humans. I'll throw this one out. The recent research at the University of Houston revealing how children who experience inadequate or disrupted sleep are more likely to develop depression and anxiety disorders later in life. And to do this study, Dr. Dykin, they evidently temporarily restricted the sleep in 50 pre-adolescent children. These are children between the ages of 7 and 11. Comment on this study and what you think its significance is.
Well, you would wonder a few things. It's difficult to do good scientific research on children because to not treat is always a scary thing, or to implement something that is negative. So it's often implicit that a parent that might allow their kid to be part of a study with sleep deprivation might have a child with a sleep problem. Mm. Be that as it may, it just sort of makes sense. So for two nights, they gave poor sleep to these kids. And generally, when they would examine them after the two nights, they had less pleasure from positive activities. They were less reactive to positive pleasurable activities and less recall about those pleasurable activities. Now, what these authors had done prior to this is they had reviewed the literature on sleep deprivation in little kids, and it was implicit that, and we've seen that, people who do not sleep well have more affective or depressive anxiety-related disorders. And they're wondering if in the developmental state of a child, very plastic, they can adapt very well, but they could maladapt. If you give them poor sleep while they're developing and you correlate this condition it will negative emotions, they may grow up to be more prone to depression and anxiety because of poor sleep.
Mm-hmm. So if parents hearing this, they're worried, of course, any parent would like their kids to have better sleep. But here, this places a greater worry on the shoulders of parents, because not only is your child sleeping poorly at the age of 7 or 8 or 9,
or 25.
But it may lead to problems later on, these anxiety problems and depression later on in life. So let's talk about at home. How can parents tackle the problem of a son or a daughter sleeping poorly on their own before they seek professional advice, perhaps?
Well, and you know, that's the difficult issue. What is normal sleep? And here in Iowa City, for an adolescent, they often go to bed much later than you and I, us old people, normally would, and they tend to sleep in longer. So making major changes in just the school system might even be the first place to start. What is normal for a child? And again, at 12 years, maybe 12 hours. When's the best bedtime? When the best arousal time? And what is the child's response to sleep deprivation? It's not always sleepiness. Sometimes it's atypical ADD.
Hyperactivity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So to even wheedle that out, it becomes very difficult. And I think the point being is you get to know your kids and you get to know yourself. If they're not getting that 9 to 12 hours of sleep, and they're not getting a routine bedtime and awakening time, and they're not doing well at school, or the emotions that we've already sort of alluded to, maybe there could be a sleep-related problem. And as this article said, as you need air, as you need exercise, as you need food, you need good restoration, good sleep.
Join our conversation with your questions. Perhaps you have a personal sleep problem. You or someone in your family has a sleep problem you'd like to share. Get some advice from Dr. Eric Dykin of the Sleep Disorder Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. 1-866-780-9100. Or you can email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Well, here's some other research. This is published last month in the journal Nature Communications. I wanted to mention and have you comment on, Dr. Dykin. Well, we all know when you don't get enough sleep, the world gets increasingly difficult to operate in. You get muddled. The little difficulties in life become bigger ones, bigger challenges. I always think it's like when you get sleep, it's like when you're driving a car, Dr. Dykin. See if you think this is a good image. Your windshield gets full of bugs, right, or a dirt from the car in front of you, and it gets increasingly hard to see and discern where you're going. And then you get to the gas station, and you do the squeegee on your windshield. And I think sometimes a nice little nap is like a squeegee on your brain. How do you like that one?
I like that a lot. That's really awfully nice.
Well, in a published study last month in the journal Nature Communications, researchers at the University of Freiburg, that's in Switzerland, isn't it? Perhaps France. They show for the first time that sleep resets the steady buildup of connectivity in the human brain, which takes place in our waking hours. Deprived of rest, the brain's, according to this write-up of it, the brain's neurons seemingly became overconnected, so muddled with electrical activity that new memories could not be properly laid down. Explain what's going on, and in this study, what has been found out.
Yeah, and you know, we have talked about some other studies that may overlap with this a little bit, and we know that the body needs restoration. Without sleep, animals die. We know that. So there's something restorative about sleep. And we know that great things, great dreams, have led to great discoveries. The benzene ring, satisfaction, blue suede shoes. I think yesterday, these things came out of dreams. But during a dream, there's an awful lot of activity. And a lot of people believe that this synaptic homeostatic hypothesis of sleep, there's a clearing, a squeegee of the brain, if you will. All the things that were presented to the memory area of the brain, the hippocampus and the temporal lobe of the brain, where all the memory is consolidated, there's too much activity there, and sleep allows you to squeegee out the crummy stuff and think of the yesterdays and satisfaction and benzene rings, the important things. And when there's overactivity by no sleep, a protein called cofilin, C-O-F-I-L-I-N, and I may be saying that wrong, just like Freiburg or Freiburg, it may be getting in the way, and sleep may allow you to get rid of the extra protein, the squeegee that out, so that the important neuronal connectivity can occur and memories can be consolidated. And I think that's what they're looking at.
Mm-hmm. And the new part of this study is that we're just understanding this better and better, and that we are getting to the root of this great mystery of why we, in fact, sleep?
Maybe so. Because, you know, if you sleep deprive an animal,
right,
it will die. And I know the PETA people have been big supporters of animals. And I cried more when my cat died, when my uncle died. My uncle's a good guy, too. But the lives are important. But from animal studies, we know that they die. If you sleep deprive an animal, and it bothers me that animals die. But human beings, you're not going to function well.
Okay. Join our conversation, Dr. Eric Dykin. We're going through some of the latest research within the last few months in the field of sleep, and there's so much that is unknown because the field of sleep actually, of course, has to do with our brains, and we have a lot to discover about our brains. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. If you'd like to share your sleep problem, or perhaps something's changed in your life, and you've changed something that's led to better sleep, we all like to learn from that as well. 1-866-780-9100. Tony is with us from Marshalltown. Hello, Tony.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine. Do you have a sleep problem to share?
I do, and I've got a question about it. I have no difficulty falling asleep. I have great difficulty staying asleep. So, and I'm in my 50s. So every evening between 2, well, every morning between 2 and 4 in the morning, I'm awake. So probably 2 years ago, I started taking either a Benadryl or a generic form of Benadryl, and it helps tremendously. Since then, I have read reports that taking this over-the-counter allergy drug can lead to short-term memory loss. And I just wondered if you had any comments about that, if that's just a myth or if that's really a true statement and if I need to do something differently.
Interesting. Tony.
Well, you take an antihistamine. So there's this area in your brain called the tuberomammillary mammillary nucleus in the hypothalamus, and it's a get-up-and-go, your reticular activating system, you know, the flight-or-fight reaction when the lion comes into the room kind of a thing. So it keeps you awake, and you take an antihistamine, and it makes you drowsy and sleepy. So it may not only induce a sleepiness, but it may also induce a post hangover, if you will, so that you may not think or encode as well, especially given the half-life of whatever you've taken, if there's a little bit of a hangover effect during the day. And as we get older, over the age of 50, which I'm well over that, that hangover effect tends to really stay with me the next day and the next day. So when I take a sedative, like after surgery, it really has more of a punch. So I'm much more sensitive, and that might be the element of this cognitive that they talk about. So many sleep experts believe you should not take a sleeping aid for any more than a 1 to 3 week period, something to get you over the hump, because we do get psychological and physiological addictions and dependencies. So it's very rare to come up with a medication that doesn't have a potential side effect. And if I were you, I would use the medication sparingly. And then you got to look at, why are you waking up at the night? Do you wake up snoring, gasping for breath? Do you have sleep apnea? Is sedating yourself when you're going to sleep with an apneic event potentially fatal kind of a problem? So then think about that with your general practitioner. You know, a lot of people are taking Benadryl, melatonin, Desiril, over-the-counter medications to help them. Alcohol is the big one. And you really don't want to become dependent every night on alcohol. So maybe sit down with your general practitioner, see why you're having these arousals at night, and see if you can avoid the consistent use of a medicine, maybe judiciously intermittent use of that medicine.
Mm-hmm. Tony, is it?
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, if I can ask, Tony, is it thoughts, concerns that are waking you, or just a lack of sleepiness?
I think it's just lack of sleepiness. And, you know, I tried to cut out caffeine. I don't drink any, take no caffeine after, you know, 7, 8 o'clock in the evening. Tried to limit the TV. I don't get on my phone. So I tried to limit the obvious things that, you know, people feel would wake somebody up. And, you know, it's miserable to be awake from 2 to 4 or 2 mm-hmm. to 5 in the morning. And but I'll try to do that. I'll sit down with my family physician and see if there's another alternative.
Remember one more thing. We call it cognitive behavioral therapeutic intervention. It is normal to have 1 to 2 arousals over a nighttime sleeping period. So don't leave the mm-hmm. bed. Have a nice book, a boring book, a comic book, you know, in Iowa City where the writer's workshop, comic book is high literature. Get a boring comic book. Don't leave the bed. Turn on the light and read until your eyes are droopy. And see if that's just as good, cognitive behavioral
okay.
therapy.
Tony, thanks
okay,
for your call.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
From,
you bet. Take care.
You too. Tony in Marshalltown. Dialed 1-866-780-9100. Dr. Eric Dyken, if you just joined us, director of the Sleep Disorder Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, taking your calls this hour. 1-866-780-9100. Let's pop over to Ames, where Judy is listening. Hi, Judy. Do you have a sleep problem of your own or something in the family?
Something in the family. We have a 12-year-old who sustained a relatively significant concussion and has a history of anxiety. My question for the doctor is this. Is there some way to modify his sleep, because he is a stomach sleeper? And we know that that's not particularly good just generally for people. So I'd be open to some suggestions for how to modify that behavior.
Well, I don't know what's wrong with sleeping on your stomach. I do it with a CPAP mask on. And the reason I probably do it is because I have obstructive sleep apnea. So I have a redundant oropharyngeal tissue, which Ben says is great for a radio voice, but it gets in the way at night. And so if I lay flat on my back, my airway closes. Now, I don't know how big this child is, haven't seen the child. I don't know if his tonsils are out. But many of us who have always slept prone or on our stomachs sleep that way because gravity opens up our throat. And I'm not that big. I weigh about 172 pounds at about 6 foot, a little over that. I lay flat on my back. Those tissues closed all my life. And then as I got older, I found out with snoring, gasping, waking up, sleepy during the day, all the signs and symptoms suggesting apnea. So changing that position, I'd be hesitant to jump to that in an apneic because you could make that worse. So why is he sleeping in the stomach? Now, as you've implied, with sudden infant death syndrome, we know that the children used to get caught in the sleep clothes. They get the CO2 narcosis, especially premature infants. We don't like them sleeping on their stomachs. But things change as we get older, and I would address that with your pediatrician. Sleep apnea has taken a tremendous exponential jump off because of the obesity explosion in the United States. And kissing tonsils, those can get in the way too in kids. And I would address that position with the child's pediatrician first, then see if it needs to be addressed.
How does that sound?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Judy.
Thank
in,
you. I appreciate it.
Oh, okay. No problems.
Thank you, Judy in Ames, 1-866-780-9100. Dr. Dykin, who's with us, director of the Sleep Disorder Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Let's see if we can get to one more call before we do take a break. David in Clinton. David in Clinton, welcome.
Hello.
How's your sleep?
Well, not great.
Okay.
It hasn't been good for a long time.
Sorry to hear that.
Well, yeah, I finally told my physician. I says, "You think I need a sleep study?" He said, "Yeah, why don't you do that?" And so I did it, and just diagnosed with sleep apnea. I haven't got my CPAP machine yet, but I guess my question is, I was diagnosed as a child with dyslexia and learning disability. While talking to my cousins and stuff, and my siblings, they says, "Well, I was a snorer growing up." You know, they always were kicking me and stuff to roll over. Well, could have my problems with my learning disability started because I just wasn't sleeping. My memory was bad.
Hmm.
Could have that been a lot to do with that? Or
hmm.
What is your opinion on that?
Yeah, well, you know, we've already implied that if you get poor sleep, memory consolidation is terrible. It's not good for your health. With the animal studies, you know, for good health in general, for emotive stability. And it's interesting, we used to have a thing called, it was called a study with atypical hyperactivity. And the kids, all they had in common was loud snoring. So they didn't do sleep studies, but they just took out their tonsils because they thought, well, maybe they all got apnea. And a statistically increased number had a resolution of their behavioral problems. So you never know, and you always wonder, but I think it at least is promising that you might have some overall improvements in the quality of your life with the CPAP machine that's coming. And I'll tell you, if I don't have my CPAP machine on, it leads to some pretty bad secondary problems, including visual loss in my right eye. It uncovered my glaucoma because when I bared down during my apneic events, it increased the intraocular pressure in my eye, and I woke up blind in my right eye. And God, she's out in Afghanistan taking care of little kids. She's not giving that vision back. I don't want to lose any more vision. If you could evidence feeling better at night, during the day, and maybe even the dyslexia kind of signs and symptoms, wouldn't that be great? Fingers crossed.
Hmm. David, all interesting. Right. I guess it is time to go have that sleep study, what your doctor recommends, right?
Yeah, right. So.
All right.
I'm hoping it clears up a whole slew of problems for me.
There you go. I can hear the exasperation in your voice, David. I hope it gets better soon.
Yeah, me too.
Okay, take care.
That's Occam's razor. If one thing could take care of many things, wouldn't that be great? But, you know, You don't want to promise Disney World to everyone, but you sure hope for good things.
Mm-hmm. Comment on this before we go to break, if you could, Dr. Dykin, some more research, which we'll go back to callers in just a bit. But this was some research done at Stanford University School of Medicine in California, published in the journal Nature Neuroscience, having to do with what it was called the reward response in the brain and how it's crucial for sleep. Comment on this, because it really does have a little bit of a bearing on children and something we didn't have as kids, with these little gizmos, electronic devices keeping us awake and rewarding us, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and this was sort of a circuitous article, actually. So we talked about the get-up-and-go nervous system, the flight or fight, what we all heard about in junior high. Well, there's the reward system, and they really sort of focused on one nucleus in the brainstem, which is our ever-ready battery that keeps us alert during the day, which has a lot of different nucleuses. So this nucleus, this group of nerves called the ventral tegmental area, when there's a reward or a pleasurable activity, this area is activated with dopamine. This is the neurotransmitter. But paradoxically, that keeps you awake. But what they've noticed, if you can turn down from this study, you turn down the dopamine, well, you get sleepy. And the problem is we've got a lot of drugs that can turn down that pleasure center to make you sleepy. One of them is Valium, the benzodiazepines. But if you overdose on that, it makes you groggy, you fall asleep, you can't think, you can't walk, you can't do anything, you can't breathe in some cases. So they think that this study might suggest a more specific target, this ventral tegmental area, this specific group of neurons. But actually, in the brainstem, there's the locus coeruleus, the dorsal raphae, the tuberomammillary nucleus, and the hypothalamus, blah, 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 blah. But it's interesting.
Mm-hmm. But here, does this go back to your advice there to find something for your bedside that is boring to read? Because if it's boring, you're not rewarding your brain, and your brain is not getting excited, and you're getting sleepy.
Well, actually, there's a lot of fun to boring and the positive conditioning. I do this every night, and that's cognitive behavioral therapy, Pavlovian conditioning, the steak and the bell. My bedroom is inviting, and I've got that same boring book that I'm looking at every evening, and I'll read a page or two. It's enough said, and it gets me to sleep.
Okay, back with more from Dr. Eric Dykin, Director of the Sleep Disorder Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Join us with your sleep problem, 1-866-780-9100. We'll be back with more of River to River, sleep news, and the latest research with Dr. Eric Dykin. We're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, Sleep News and Research. Dr. Eric Dykin is with us, neurologist and director of the Sleep Disorder Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. We're catching up on our sleep news and also taking questions from you. We have plenty of them to get to this half hour. If you'd like to join us, 1-866-780-9100. Share your sleep problem or unusual sleep experience. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. A little later in the program, a quick comment on some new research that for the first time researchers have discovered that birds can sleep in flight. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Also, findings that actually trees may sleep as well. But first, let's go back to our and this email from one of our listeners, Dr. Dykin. Ben, an emailer, listener, writes, I periodically have sleep paralysis. I will partially awaken but can't actually move my body, but I'm aware of what is around me, and it is extremely terrifying because typically there will be an intruder in the room while it is happening, meaning I can see a presence in the room in my peripheral vision, and I can hear footsteps. It happens more often to me when I fall asleep laying on my back. Can you speak to this? Sounds terrifying. Yeah. I've actually experienced, everybody's had at one time or another, this you're awake, and then it's like your body is encased in concrete.
Yeah.
You cannot move.
Yeah. 40% of all normal people sometime throughout their lifetime, it's estimated, have a sleep paralytic event, especially if they're sleep deprived. The Chinese Book of Dreams first looked at this, thousands of years ago, and the sleep paralytic events they thought were related to angry ancestors. But we think it's more of a REM, rapid eye movement dream, or paralyzed sleep intrusion, especially in a sleep-deprived person. And with that paralysis, since it's part of dreaming sleep, in normal dreaming sleep, we're paralyzed to some extent so that we don't act out our dreams. And there are three types of dreams that go along with sleep paralysis. One is the intruder. You're not able to move and you think someone's in the room. Number two is the incubus. That's when the intruder is trying to strangle you. And there's a famous picture from the 1800s of a lady being attacked by a little demon on her chest. And the third is the out-of-body experience, where you actually see yourself in the dream. You're outside the body. But it's all part of this transitional period of a REM-like phenomenon. And we've all had this. You get really sleep-deprived, and you're watching TV, and you're early morning with your friends or whatever, and then all of a sudden you have this dream that you're falling, and your body sort of jerks. Well, that's called a sleep start. And people always say, well, you know, if in the dream that you're falling, if you hit the ground, you would die. Well, who lived to tell that tale, kind of a thing? But that's that phenomenon we've all had, the sleep start, the sleep paralysis, especially if you're sleep deprived. You can be sleep deprived for a million reasons. If it's worse on your back, we've talked about, make sure you don't have sleep apnea.
So the short version of advice to Ben, our emailer, would be that he may be sleep deprived.
You may be sleep deprived, or if it's in the supine position, even if you're skinny, even little kids can have sleep apnea. If you snore, you wake up gasping, have insomnia, and wake up sleepy in the morning, sometimes with daytime headaches. If you're overweight, and if it's real tight in the back of your throat, big tonsils, maybe talk to your doctor about that.
Okay, neurologist Dr. Eric Dykin, director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Let's go to our phones. Roberta is in West Des Moines. Most of the show we've talked about people not getting enough sleep. I understand, Roberta, your problem is that you get too much sleep. How much sleep do you get? When do you go to bed?
How much sleep do I get?
Yeah.
If I'm left to my own devices, I can sleep soundly from about 9:30 at night until ideally 8:30 or 9 in the morning.
You know, that sounds like a dream to a lot of listeners with sleep problems, but is it a problem for you, and in what way?
Well, yes. I just returned from a vacation where I was a guest in a friend's home. This friend sleeps maybe 4 or 5 hours a night, so she'd be up ready to go with coffee going at 6:30, 7 o'clock, and she'd check on me because obviously not very many people sleep this long. And I never open my mouth. I'm 62. And I never discuss this with people because I know that everybody complains about not getting enough sleep or having hot flashes.
You feel bad like complaining about too much sleep, right? But here in this case, it was causing some problems because, you're mismatched with the person that you're vacationing with.
Well, with everybody, with the whole world, except for teenagers.
There you go. Dr. Dykin, what do you have for Roberta as far as advice?
Well, how long have you been doing this? When did it first start?
Well, I think I did it a lot when I was in high school and college, and then having children, of course, I couldn't. But my kids were pretty good sleepers. And since I've been empty nest, I'd say probably 10 years.
Does it cause you any problems during the day? Do you fall asleep driving a car, boring conversations?
No. It's just that it's abnormal for somebody my age.
Well.
I think, and it's a little embarrassing for somebody to say, let's meet for breakfast at 8, and I'm thinking to myself, I'll just be getting up at 8, and they'll be up at 6 o'clock. And Well, I would like to wake up a little bit earlier, but I don't want to go to sleep any earlier.
Well, there's a bell-shaped curve of normalcy, and some people can get by with 5 hours of sleep, and that's at the feet of the bell-shaped curve, you know, 3-4% of the population. Most of us adults need 7 to 9 hours of sleep, but sleep does change over a period of time. But you tell me you came out of the womb like this. You've been a long sleeper your entire life, and there are long sleepers, and there are people.
And I'm a napper. I can take a nap and still fall asleep at 9 o'clock.
Yeah,
I've always been a napper.
And there are some people with what we call idiopathic hypersomnia. They have more of the sleepy juice, the GABAergic, if you will, and the hypothalamus. It's the sleep switch, if you will. That's our thought. If it doesn't interfere with the quality of your life, what's the big deal? But 12 hours of sleep in the working population is difficult. And sometimes we will call that an idiopathic hypersomnia. But there are a lot of things that can cause sleepiness, but you don't see a side effect of your sleepiness. Now, you're not snoring at night, is that right?
I probably snore, but there's nobody here to tell me.
How about your friend when you were on your vacation? Has anyone ever complained of that?
We have different rooms. Oh, my daughter teases me that if I would fall asleep in a recliner, I'd snore, but she does too.
Well, you know, and when my wife and I talked about our snoring, I was in tears, she was in tears, because it's socially unacceptable. But you can't help it. But I have sleep apnea.
No.
And my thought is, if you're snoring, if you're this sleepy, you're calling for a reason, I would talk to your doctor about the potential of sleep apnea. Why do I do that? Because snoring and sleeping this much is what often happens in sleep apnea, and that's not a safe thing to keep untreated. Easy to treat, easy to take care of. Talk to your doctor. Look at the other signs and symptoms. Do a full medical workup. Have them look down your throat, et cetera, et cetera. See if there's another reason for this than this is just the way you were born. Because sleep apnea is not a good thing for you to be having because it's low oxygen to your heart, your brain, and as I've implied, my eye every night unless I'm treated.
Okay.
But then go from there.
Well, I was going to suggest, too, I like to swim and I like to walk. And I work, my hours accommodate my schedule for sleeping somewhat. So, and then if I have to get up at 5:30 to go to work, I'm fine. That's what I had to do today, and I'm fine. I'll be fine until 9 o'clock tonight.
Sounds
I'm
like
just
you.
Left
you
my own devices.
All right.
That's
Roberta,
what I choose to sleep.
Thank you very much. Sounds like it, maybe to check that out, getting 12, 13 hours of sleep a day. We appreciate you calling in. Roberta from West Des Moines. 1-866-780-9100. Let's get to back to some research before we go back to the phones that involve non-human living organisms. For the first time, researchers have discovered that birds can sleep in flight. You're flying along and you're sleeping. Together with an international team of colleagues, someone named Niels Rattenburg from the Max Planck Institute for Ornithology in Germany, they measured the brain activity of frigate birds. Dr. Dyken, these are these huge birds. They have some wingspans over 2 meters wide, excellent gliders. They can cover several hundred miles in a day. These researchers found that they sleep in flight with either one cerebral hemisphere at a time or both hemispheres simultaneously. So in reading this study, are we to understand that these birds can turn off part of their brain, have part of their brain go to sleep, while the other one's sort of an autopilot?
Well, you know, they've known that about many birds, dolphins. I mean, dolphins got to, they're mammals, they got to breathe. So how do they keep alive if they're trying to sleep? So half of the brain can be sleeping while the other half is keeping you awake and alive and flying. What they thought was fascinating about this study is both hemispheres turn off. And it's a relatively simple, straightforward activity.
How do you stay in flight if both of your hemispheres turn off?
You can glide. And I think that's the big thing about these big birds. They would go up and they can glide and they have very short sleep periods. They can even go into REM or paralyzed sleep. and they were monitoring the movement of the heads, and the heads would drop, sort of like the sleep start we talked about, the sleep paralysis, for just seconds. But that's all they needed. So they found it was fascinating that both hemispheres go to sleep, but when they monitored these animals, the average flight time sleep over a 24-hour period, 42 minutes. But when they got to land, they more than made up for it with 12 hours per day.
They catch up on the
sleep.
Yeah,
so they're not... The fascinating thing is they get very, very little sleep because they do have to be awake. And in fact, when one hemisphere, like a duck, you know, they're sitting there. Have you ever seen the geese that are out there and they're protecting all their little babies? They're all over my ponds. Everything's all over my ponds. But they'll keep one eye open, one hemisphere awake, and the other hemisphere is asleep, and they'll keep that eye away from the children looking for predators. And boom, they'll wake up and they'll get out into the water.
Mm.
So the one hemisphere is pretty cool. And the reason they sleep very little is bad things can happen when you're flying. And predators can come when you're on the ground.
Mm. Interesting research on birds from the Max Planck Institute in Germany. Let's talk about trees. Do trees sleep? Well, scientists from Austria, Finland, and Hungary are using laser scanners to study the day night rhythm of trees, and as it turns out, trees do sleep, apparently. This international team of scientists measured the sleep movement of fully grown trees using a time series of laser scanning point clouds consisting of millions of points each. The results, Dr. Dyken, showing that the whole tree droops during the night, which can be seen as a position change in its leaves and branches. So just like we droop and fall into bed, evidently these trees, which of course stay upright the whole night, droop a tiny bit. What do you see in this study?
Yeah, up to 10 centimeters for trees with a height of about 5 meters. So, you know, we've all done that in junior high and elementary, and you take the flower and you put it in the sunroom, and where does the flower tend to be looking at? And the flower will address the sun. It will turn, it will move, and trees will grow, you know, around the periphery of the fields here in Iowa toward the sun. So we know that there's this circadian rhythm that is set by dark light schedule of nighttime and daytime through the sun. And trees, though, those are great big monsters. They don't turn as easily as a flower would. And the studies that we did in junior high, I remember doing this in junior high, the bright light, it would work toward that. I mean, trees are really, really big, and turning on a light changes the arousal pattern of a plant, if you will. So this laser was really cool in that there was no light associated with it that might induce a daytime-like environment. So it's in the dark, it's with lasers, and yeah, it looks like the trees droop. There's a relaxation. They took into consideration the wind, the weather, the location. Yeah, pretty cool.
Mm-hmm, but there's a tree doesn't have a brain like us in our sense, so we're in the consolidation of memories. You know, remember the squeegee on the windshield?
Mm.
So do we think trees need that sort of thing?
No, but I think we think trees need rest. And I think things can turn down. And as we said, if you have an overactive brain, these cofilin proteins, the ability to encode, the ability to live from the sleep deprivation studies in animals, I think even trees need to hibernate sometime.
Neurologist Dr. Eric Dyken of the University of Iowa with us, our sleep expert. We have just a few minutes left. We'll try to have brief answers and see how many we can get to before the hour ends. Rod is with us in Cedar Rapids. Rod, thank you for joining us. Please turn down the radio in the background, if you could.
Hi, sorry about that.
Not a problem. Go ahead.
My daughter is 14 years old, always been a good sleeper, but she just started high school. And she's a swimmer, so she exercises a fair amount. And regardless, for the past month and a half since school started, she has been waking up two or three times a night. And so she's not getting that deep sleep, but she's getting tired during the day. We're trying a little melatonin just recently. That doesn't seem to be doing it. So we're a little concerned about affecting her school and everything else she's involved in. And she says so she's feeling the stress of starting the freshman year is gone. She feels more comfortable now, but it seems like she can't shake that bad sleep pattern.
Hmm.
Well, you know, it is interesting. They talked about that pleasure, ventral tegmental area. And if you are excited about school, you mentioned she's a swimmer. Boy, I would get up early, being slightly hyper. I would at school, it would be exciting for me. I'd get up early, didn't sleep well. I'd think about what's going on during the day, that kind of a thing. And many of us, and even here at the university, they offer a course to all faculty, all staff. And I think Ben took this. It's a course in cognitive behavioral therapy, about an 8-week period, and it teaches you what you may already know, simple, good sleep hygiene patterns, when to start turning things down within a half hour to 45 minutes before bedtime, when to make the bed clothes and the boring book and the lights and get rid of the texting and the email messages. It's, again, teaching you the obvious on the temperature, when to eat and when to wake up and whether you use an alarm clock. So I think you can Google that. You can even check with the University of Iowa what they're offering as far as their course, but thinking of simple things like an athlete might do with a personal trainer. Sometimes you know you want to build up biceps, you lift dumbbells. But sometimes you need to have a trainer to make the Olympics.
Mm-hmm. And Ron, if I could jump in here too, it was Dr. Dykin was referring to the course that I took. One thing, and Dr. Dykin has referred to this many times, maybe have your daughter keep a sleep journal so that you can learn from, you know, she will get X number of hours of sleep, and then she knows, okay, does that correspond with how I feel during the day? Do I feel good with a certain number of hours of sleep, or how much did I eat before going to bed, and things like that. That was really a learning experience for me to day after day for weeks to match up good or bad sleep with my daytime habits.
Patient, heal thyself.
There you go. Rod, does that give you something to go on? We hope your daughter's going to be doing well and keep on swimming, because that is a healthy activity.
And remember, depression does affect the young kids today. We're blessed with so many things. If this persists, make sure you have a good pediatrician. Look for the stresses and pressures that can occur in school. This is an active time for young people, and it can happen.
Thank you, Rod.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
And we're coming to the end of the hour. Let's see. Let's go to an email. This email from Stephanie. I never have nightmares, writes Stephanie. I have stress dreams. Late to work, forgot about something important, and so on. And I've had dreams that make me incredibly sad or angry, but never afraid. I do remember my dreams quite vividly as well when I remember them. Is this unusual, asks Stephanie. So I guess she doesn't have nightmares. She has stress things. She's a vivid dreamer. Is this unusual?
Well, you know, the rose by any other name. I mean, I would say that she's having stress. I'd call them nightmares. When you're under stress, it is normal to have dream-related concomitant. I used to bale hay. Oh, man, if you ever baled hay, I would have the same repetitive, and it was very uncomfortable. I used to not be prepared for tests. I still have that dream today that I'm med school final. Oh, my daughter has the same kind of dream. Stress and pressure, it is not unusual to have those kind of dreams. So, no, it's not. And this is a 24-hour society. The reason we're even giving this radio show is that it's ubiquitous across the nation. 70% of all normal adult Americans, according to the 2002 National Sleep Foundation poll, have a major problem or sleep or sleepiness because of the stress of everyday life.
Let me get in two quick questions about CPAP. We won't get to the caller, but he says you mentioned earlier that you sleep on your stomach with a CPAP. The caller says, how is that possible? He says, isn't that deadly due to CO2?
No, there's a release valve at the top, and it blows out the top of my mask. So I've got this new Amara View mask, and I've got so many arthritic problems. I've got a Chinese body pillow, a neck pillow. So it looks like a mess, but it's comfortable for me. So I arrange my position.
Another CPAP, and CPAP again stands for, just so people know,
continuous positive airway pressure therapy through a mask that keeps your airways open.
To treat the sleep apnea, that floppy throat thing that prevents you from breathing correctly while you're asleep. Very quickly, Steve emailing about CPAP. I've been diagnosed with sleep apnea, right, Steve? I have a CPAP machine. However, every time I use it, I seem to experience an allergy attack the next day. The machine is new. It has clean filters and a new mask. What's going on there, possibly?
Maybe it's just irritated sinuses. You never know. And so, you know, you should talk to your doctor about that. There is a punch to it. There's a pressure activity. It could be sensitive nasal passages. And you can also look for other therapeutic interventions. There are oral devices. There are stimulatory devices. There are positional devices. Although across the board, good heated humidity. Check to make sure your humidity level is high. CPAP's pretty good.
A little bit of the email I neglected to mention. He writes, continues, my theory is that it dries out my sinuses, making me more susceptible to my allergies.
Heated humidity. Turn it up to 5. It's good for the glottis and your sinuses.
Okay, you're good for us. Giving us sleep advice, Dr. Eric Dyke, a neurologist, director of the Sleep Disorder Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. We look forward to having you back when the days are a bit shorter. Perhaps we'll talk about light and sleep.
Perfect.
Thank you very much, Dr. Eric Dyke, of the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. And River to River, produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, with help from Gray Lanta and Divine Huss. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back tomorrow with more River to River.
So tired, I don't know what to do.